Welcome to this week's Some Other Scotland headline newscast with me, Mick Bourdais. In Scotland's news this last week, locals demand nuclear beach tidy. Low-level radiation found on a beach in Dalgetty Bay
has led to calls for the Ministry of Defence to clean the area, as the source has apparently been traced to aircraft dials painted with radium. Although the level of radiation is low, local residents are advised not to lift items from the beach. The Scottish Environment Protection Agency, SEPA, has supported this request. Red versus grey, squirrels do battle. A project has been launched to save Scotland's red squirrel population from decimation at the hands of the non-native grey squirrel. Several groups, including the Scottish Wildlife Trust and Scottish Natural Heritage, have given their support to the programme, which will be likely to involve some culling of grey squirrels in those areas where they are known to be moving towards red squirrel territory. Geller outbid for fourth isle. Yuri Geller's bid to purchase a small island off the coast of North Berwick, known as the Lamb, failed this week as a last-minute buyer stepped in to the negotiations with a higher offer. The island, home to a large number of rare birds, is too small to build on, but Geller claimed he was interested in the layout of the islands, which mirrors that of the Great Pyramids of Egypt. The identity of the buyer was not made public. Now the walls really do have ears. A trial has taken place in Glasgow of CCTV cameras fitted with microphones and a system for detecting aggressive voices. The Dutch company running the trial have insisted that the conversations are not recorded and that the main aim is to ensure that cameras are pointed towards aggressive behaviour. Patrick Harvey of the Scottish Green Party said, "It's probably fair enough to trial them, but I'd rather people trial them in a more open way." If nothing else, the trial could result in Scotland having some of the most polite and softly spoken violent attacks on our streets. Celtic Fire Station to close. The Fire Brigades Union has warned that the proposed closure of Parkhead Fire Station may lead to an increase in fatalities due to the longer response times incurred from a station further away. The plans are set to merge the Parkhead Station with the Cambus Lang Station in a new facility close to the M74, which would result in an increase in response time from 3.5 minutes to around 8 minutes. Plans to cut off Scotland from oil revealed. 30-year-old documents have come to light which show proposals in 1975 by the Assistant Treasury Secretary to redraw Scottish coastal waters to neutralise any claim Scotland would have to oil fields, as well as a suggestion that support of independence for Orkney and Shetland would help to split territorial claims. A Labour spokesman stated that such views were not shared by the whole Labour Party, despite nationalists pointing out that the author of the report is now advising the Prime Minister on the banking crisis. MSPs say no to ID scheme. The Scottish Government has written to the Home Office to state its opposition to the use of identity cards in the UK. MSPs supported a motion to state that a crime would be unaffected by the introduction of the cards, and that significant concerns remained about the implications to civil liberties. Don't forget to vote for next week's podcast subject at the website, which is someotherscotland.blogspot.com. You can leave comments about any episode. If you'd like to leave feedback in general, you can email me at mickbourdais@gmail.com. Some Other Scotland by Mick Bourdais. Episode 7. "Home again," said Harold Grant as he stepped from the rickety rowing boat onto the rocky isle. The boat kept bumping up and down until he dragged it by the rope attached to the bow along to the small inlet that would keep it safe from the larger waves and out of sight from the mainland. He tied the rope to a jagged outcrop of rock, then stood up and looked around. Behind him lay the Firth of Forth, and beyond that the North Sea, cast in a broody grey shade by the low-lying dark clouds overhead. In front, the direction from which he had arrived, was the North Berwick coast, and to either side, the two sister islands of the Lamb. He'd been away for months, dealing with business matters in London and research in Egypt, and hadn't expected to return for at least another month. The sale of the island had demanded his return. The previous owner had inherited the tiny volcanic outcrop and had never even visited it. He would quite happily have let somebody new take ownership, probably some rich city playboy who just wanted to be able to brag about owning a Scottish island. He'd seen it happen before, and it didn't bother him. There was no intrinsic value to the lamb. It wasn't large enough to build on, it had no mineral resources, and its only scientific value was that it was home to a relatively large number of uncommon seabirds. It was also his home. But nobody had ever known, or even suspected, that such a small, apparently insignificant place could be just so important. That could all have changed, though, with the latest potential buyer, the Spoonbender. A little knowledge is dangerous, he thought, and despite the gentle mocking of the press, the information Galler had released about his plans for the island suggested that not only was he heading along the right track with his pronouncements, but that he was at risk of revealing the true nature of the lamb's history. Harald had to step into the negotiations at this point and bid over the asking price to ensure that the island's secrets remained hidden. There was too much to lose at this point, so he had to weigh up the benefits of not being traceable to the island as he had been until now, with the problems that would ensue if the Spoonbender took ownership. The last thing he needed was a bunch of pseudo-spiritual semi-scientists arriving en masse, with a case full of dowsing rods, crystals and astrological charts to start digging around. He took a deep breath. Not going to happen, he said to himself, satisfied with his choice. The wind picked up, and an icy gust laced with cold, salty water buffeted at his face. He pulled the zip on the waterproof jacket to the top, burying his dark, thickly bearded chin under a warm, protective layer, and set off towards the centre of the island. Once there, he withdrew the control box from his pocket, moved his finger in a zigzag gesture across its black surface, and waited. The horizon slowly began to rise around him, as the metre-square section of rock he was standing on descended silently into the ground. Within 30 seconds, there was no evidence that anybody had been in the lam, apart from a single rowing boat. A bit early for April Fools, isn't it, lads? Sykes said, looking at the picture on the computer screen.
Honest, boss, that's what he's saying. By all accounts, he looks the part too. Wee coat and frilly jacket. Aye, the works,
answered Dewar, the youngest member of Sykes' small team.
Well, I'm sorry to have to break it to you and your nationalist buddies, but Bonnie Prince Charlie died over 200 years ago. Whoever this joker is, I think he'd be a bit more haggard if he really were the young pretender, don't you?
I know, sir, but he really does think that's who he is. We just need to find out who's missing a nutter. Maybe one of the hysterical societies, you know, the ones that do the battles and that.
Yeah, that might be worth a shot. Get a list of historical reenactment groups and try the Historic Scotland and the NTS. They do events with actors dressed up like that every so often. Is there anything else he's saying? Sykes asked.
He looked at the young officer sat at the computer first, then around the room at the other policemen. One of them, DC Lake, looked down at a set of papers in his hands and spoke up.
All he remembers is his name, Charles Edward Stewart, and that he was trapped in a room in the basement of the house. He claims there was no door, and he had to burn his way out.
Rassie House, yes?
Anything in the fire brigade report? Sykes asked. Lake nodded and flicked over a couple of sheets to check the details before answering.
They confirmed the story, at least part of it. The fire was started deliberately in the basement, though that part of the building was pretty much gutted. So whether there was a room with no door is anybody's guess. They found him lying in a ditch about a mile away from the house. Out cold. He's been lying in the hospital till last night when he regained consciousness. Okay. Stick up the usual notices and copy the pictures out to the boys in the beat. Dewar, add theatres and drama colleges to your list to check for missing persons.
Dewar switched programs on the computer to add the actions to his list of things to do, but Sykes stopped him before he could type anything.
What's that? He said, pointing to the screen. That's a scan of the piece of paper he had on him. The local force has sent off already for translation. They couldn't make head or tail of it, Dewar replied. Get me a print of that, will you? Sykes asked.
Dewar nodded and pressed the print icon on screen. Sykes picked the page off the printer and took it back to his desk. The paper was covered in handwritten letters, many so covered in swooping flourishes as to be indecipherable, others forming words he suspected were Latin and possibly Gaelic. What had first caught his eye, though, were the symbols interspersed with the text. Symbols he had seen before. Only once. at the palace. They were the same as those which had been microscopically etched into the cameras found at the palace and at the Scottish Parliament building. This was no longer a simple missing persons case in reverse. It was another link, possibly even an answer, to the mystery that had been playing on his mind for weeks. He picked up his phone and dialed the number for Callum Haston. She had seen the exact point where the pillar had disappeared into the ground, but there was little Erica could do about it. Dusting around the area showed no signs of the disturbance, and she was reluctant to start digging into a well-recognised feature of a priceless piece of prehistory. She sat down beside the hearth area in the middle of the tiny house, never letting her eyes stray from the centrepiece of the room, willing the stone to rise again so that she could demand answers.
"So, just what the heck was that? An elevator?"
she asked herself out loud.
"It certainly appeared to be, but that would mean there would need to be a damn strong mechanism under there to lift something that heavy up under control. Which in turn begs the question, how long has that been there? It's either a recent addition, by means unknown, or it's been there for hundreds of years. Thousands, maybe."
For another 2 hours she sat, talking the evening's events over with herself, imagining what lay under the rock beneath her and further on down the tunnel. Her thoughts skipped between the possibilities opening themselves before her, about the find, and about the girl Tanya. Who was she really? Was she even a student? There was no doubt in Erica's mind of the knowledge and skills already displayed by the young archaeologist, but was that because she was already ahead of them all in her experience of this place? Had she discovered something new before anyone else? Or was she a party to something much older? A scraping hiss broke the silence, a noise so quiet that it wouldn't have been heard except in the dead of night. It brought Erica's attention back to the centre of the room, to the source of the sound. The hearth area was rising again. She slid along the floor to the shadow of the wall behind and waited, hoping to catch the occupant off guard. When Tanya's face appeared out of the ground, framed by the coffin-like stone surround, she was looking directly at Erica, who shifted her position, feeling the wall pressing hard on her back, its stony chill adding to the shiver already running through her body. She'd been expecting to take the offensive approach, asking questions, demanding to know what was going on, but instead she found herself in awe of the perfect stone form rising from the ground in front of her. There was no reason for her to say anything as she admired the grace with which the pillar rose, the elegance of the silent mechanism, and the imposing figure within. The pillar stopped, without any sign of slowing down or shuddering to a halt as you would expect with a normal metal lift. Tanya stepped out towards Erica. She gave an embarrassed half-smile and offered her hand, saying, "I think this might be a good time for an explanation." Harold stepped off the plinth before it had reached the bottom of its descent and the lights in the room activated, growing in brightness as he crossed from the entrance to the only visible feature, a rectangular slot to the left of the far wall. The room was triangular in shape. The two walls on either side of the entrance had been hewn from the island's natural rough stone, whilst the third was constructed in a smooth black rock, 20 meters long. He raised the control box and slid it into the slot, then ran his fingers over the wall where the box now rested, invisible to the naked eye, as though it were all part of the same onyx-black surface. Several symbols illuminated around the slot, some of which Harold then touched, activating the download process to transfer the data he'd collected since he was last here from the control box into the island's archive. A few seconds later, another set of symbols appeared on the wall, indicating transfer was complete. He moved to the centre and tapped a pattern with his fingers onto that part of the wall. 9 images, each a metre square, appeared directly on the rock in a grid in front of him. Each image was different. Some showed people walking around in a city, others showed empty rooms, and 2 showed a man's face staring directly out from a wall. Harold's attention was immediately drawn to this face. It was the same man, the same face, but none of the cameras were located together, he thought. That could only mean that 2 of the cameras had been found, a fact emphasised by the way the man was staring directly into the lens. "Damn it," he muttered, tapping on the wall again to view the next series of images. Nothing to worry about there, he was relieved to see. The following series had another face staring into the lens, though. This was a different face, younger than the first man, but bearing a similar inquisitive expression as the first. He banged his fist against the wall in annoyance, and the images disappeared.
"That's three of the Edinburgh cameras down. All this time we've never lost one, and now three go in as many months. At least they've already served their purpose. Though they were in some pretty useful places, it would have been good to keep such high-level sights within our view. I better check the rest."
He tapped on the wall again, and the images returned. After looking them over, he switched to another series of viewpoints, then another. In the final series, a black image made him clench his fists before moving his finger across the image, causing it to play in reverse. Nothing was visible apart from a blackness for several seconds, and then a brief flash of yellow and a return to a dark image of a body lying in a small room. He tapped on the picture and played it forward, letting him see the figure gain consciousness, find his bearings, set a fire and escape before the camera became covered in black soot from the fire.
"So, our bonny prince is back with us," he said. "That's going to change everything."
The music from this podcast is from the track No Strings Attached by The Lunacy Board, who can be found at www.lunacyboard.com. The podcast is produced under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 license, which means, in a nutshell, that you can copy it ad infinitum, email it to your friends, stick it on your webpage or your MP3 player or iPod, anything you like. Just so long as you don't change it in any way, you don't make money from it, and you let people know where it has come from originally. SomeOtherScotland.blogspot.com